it's Nick Hopwood, founder and president of Peak Wealth Management. And today on the podcast, we will not be talking about finance. We will be talking about football, Michigan football. And if you don't like that, tough, because it's my podcast. And if I want to talk about football, I will. I'm just kidding, but it will be about football. And today my guest will be a Mr. Chris Dupre, one of my very best friends. We met at college at Michigan our freshman year, and Chris is a great resource when it comes to Michigan football. He wrote for the Michigan Daily. He was in the press conference during the football games, wrote the beat article a couple every week. So he's very highly educated on the sport and loves Michigan football probably more than anyone I know. And so he writes this fantastic preview, the Michigan season preview, each year. He's done it every year since 2001. And it's a shame because I know he puts a lot of effort into this. And, you know, I don't think that the distribution, we'll say, is as good as it should be, because more people should be gaining insight from Chris. So I thought, hey, what a great idea. We could have Chris on the podcast and lace a track down on audio so more people can listen, or more people can hear from Chris and what his thoughts are. So without further ado, let's welcome Christopher Robert Dupre.
It's great to have Chris Dupre on the podcast today. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So Chris and I go way back. I want to say 1997, probably like September 1st, something like that, Labor Day weekend, welcome week,
the University. Right around when the world got good.
Yeah, right. So, you know, some of you may know that I grew up in the East Lansing area as a Spartan fan and a big-time Michigan hater. I really hated Michigan, like Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, you know, all those guys. They were on my short list. But it was pretty easy to become a Michigan fan that first week walking to the Colorado game, right, Chris?
Yeah, hard to believe we had to wait two full weeks for that Colorado game due to that. The way the schedule was structured, I think the first game was September 14th. It would be unconscionable to wait that long for a football game now.
I don't remember it that way, but I'll take your word for it. What I do remember is, you know, walking to the stadium for the first time with you, and again, growing up as a Spartan, I didn't know the Victors, and you're like teaching me how to sing the Victors fight song like on the way to the first game.
I remember them doing that in orientation because you had people that were from out of state that didn't know the Victors, and it was hard for me to understand, you know, that somebody would come in not knowing that. But, you know, I lived 30 minutes from campus, and it was part of our family and who we were. So I guess I learned that not required comprehension for everyone.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking with Chris about the Michigan football season preview 2019, kind of awkward that two games are in the bag, but every year for probably since 2001, like when we graduated, you've put out this preview document.
Yes.
I always enjoy it, and it's always like coming later and later each season, like with kids at home, right? Like now we get it like on Friday night before the first game.
Yes. My it's hard to explain at home, you know, why are you writing this, and you get paid for it? No, but, you know, others have come to expect some humor, and I try and provide that.
Well, I appreciate it very much. It's very well written, and obviously, one of the reasons why Chris is doing this, not to put words in your mouth, but Chris was a writer at the Michigan Daily for 4 years, like one of the top dudes at the Michigan Daily while we were there. And so you had the basketball beat junior year and the football beat senior year, is that right?
Yes, on both.
And then what else? Hockey and then just a staffer?
Had hockey as a sophomore. You come in at the Daily and they ask you what you want to write when you're a freshman. And then before you have a chance to answer, the senior that's running the department says, do not write down football. And I was dumb enough to think I would walk in there in the fall of 1997 and put football, and then they'd, you know, send me to the games. So I spent time writing for the cross country and track teams because at least I'd, you know, played those sports and knew something about it, and then started doing hockey my sophomore year, basketball, and then football, like you said.
What's your greatest memory writing for the Daily as a student, like football related?
My greatest memory is, unfortunately, I am still the answer to the trivia question, who was the game columnist for the Michigan Daily the last time Michigan football won in Columbus? And that was in 2000, November 2000, 38-26 over Ohio State. And Drew Henson sealed it on fourth and goal from maybe the two-yard line with a naked bootleg. And he paused, froze the linebacker and got around him for the game-sealing touchdown. And it was the coldest football game I've ever been at. Had to be 15 degrees out. I stood next to some butane heaters on the Michigan sideline just to keep warm.
I remember that vividly. In fact, I was just watching that Drew Henson naked boot run on YouTube the other day with showing the kids that play and how they did have that defensive end right there ready to make the play, but Henson juked him out and ran into the touchdown untouched.
And, of course, you got Lloyd, who, you know, always thought he was so savvy and tricky. John Cooper had called a timeout, or maybe Michigan had called a timeout before fourth down to plan on what to do. The score was 31-26 at that point, so you thought, well, if Michigan kicks for three, they'll have an 8-point lead and things, and 8-point lead feels pretty good at that point. And you can see Cooper mouth on TV that they're going to kick the field goal, go up by eight, and Lloyd sent out Hayden Epstein to try and practice some kicks on an empty field during the timeout. And then when the referee took the ball to play, off came Epstein and on came the Michigan offense. So Lloyd with his trickery one last time in the Ohio State.
I love that. Speaking of Lloyd, I took the boys to the Army game this past weekend, and wouldn't you know, right behind the tailgate, here comes Lloyd walking through. He was actually the honorary captain for the game as well, but he comes walking past us, and all of a sudden people are realizing there he goes, and now he's got a crowd around him. And so I'm never afraid to jump into the mix, so I grabbed the boys, and I said, come with me, and I yelled out, Coach, can I get a picture with the boys? And he said, as long as you're not in the picture. And then smiled and waved me in. So we got a nice picture with Lloyd. And then, hey, at halftime, we got a nice picture with Xavier Simpson as well, which was really cool.
Yeah, I saw both of those. That was great. I was at the game, but I didn't fare as well as you did seeing Michigan luminaries.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a fun pregame and a very difficult game itself. But one more thing about that 2000 Columbus game, that was actually our senior year, and we were turning 21. My wife has a kind of a late birthday. She turned 21, and me and a couple buddies and my wife and my girlfriend at the time, we went down for that weekend. And let me tell you, you don't want to be in Columbus wearing Michigan maize and blue. It's just not a good idea.
For sure.
I've done it twice. It was not good. So. Yeah. So anyway, Chris wrote for the Daily. I remember vividly, you know, on Monday mornings when you're going into class, picking up the Michigan Daily, and there's Chris's picture there, Duke's Scoop column, right, you know, kind of like the featured column on the front page talking about Michigan football and you know, what happened on Saturday.
A lot of great memories, and, you know, it was a lot of work, but when you're sitting there 10 minutes before kickoff at some of these games, that was what you put in the time for, and made a lot of great friends too.
Absolutely. So that kind of after graduation kind of inspired you to start writing the season preview each August. And so when I was reading the one last, I guess 2 weeks ago, the newest edition, I thought to myself, we need to like record this into some sort of audio instead of just being written. So, you know, even more people can get your thoughts.
Yeah, well, writing hides my nasal voice.
So, going through this new article you wrote, last year's kickoff party was the Notre Dame game. We were there. It was a great experience, and I have to say that I hated Notre Dame as a kid. You know, when you're a Spartan, you kind of hate the big brother. That's the way it works. Notre Dame kicked our butt, so I was not a Notre Dame fan. And after going to Notre Dame and witnessing what a class act they really are. The campus is beautiful. The people were kind, and they're educated about football. And I have to say, I do not hate Notre Dame anymore. But, you know, we lost. So that was the bad part of it. But I had a good trip. So you were somewhere else last year, and you had some funny things to write in your article about being the best man and giving that speech.
Yep, a longtime friend of mine from my hometown in Novi. Got married at the ripe old age of 39 for the first time, and he went to Western Michigan, and so, you know, college football is something on his radar, but it's not the most important thing on his radar, and I can't knock it given that I got married in the fall myself. But his wedding was set for September 1st. He asked me to be the best man. I was happy to do it, honored to do it. It did mean I was going to miss this nighttime kickoff, and that was okay. So I tried to just focus on what I was doing and avoid the score. And of course, you stow all your possessions in the back room because the last thing you want is your cell phone on to, you know, unintentionally ring or something during a key moment. So you put all that stuff in the back. And, you know, after the speech was over and that was behind me, and did really well with that. And I snuck back there. I figured somebody's going to tell me. I might as well find out on my own terms. And then I see it's already 14-0. We're 8 minutes in. And at that point, you know, I don't want to know. I don't need to know. I already see the writing on the wall with the way this is going. And so it was better just to go back and enjoy the night.
Yeah. Going down 14-0 after two possessions was awful. And, you know, that was like 8 minutes left in the first quarter. It just was a bad start. So maybe you were better off at the wedding instead of being at the game.
I asked my father afterwards, should I, you know, watch the game to get some context for the season, understand how we played, what personnel are in, and his advice was just to ditch it, that I'd get nothing valuable out of it, and it would only serve to frustrate me. So I heeded that advice.
And I think last year you picked Michigan going undefeated, and we were like 10-2 in the regular season, so that was pretty close. Of course, the Notre Dame loss and the Ohio State loss. And this year, it looks like you've got us with one loss, losing to Ohio State. Is that right?
That was true as of August 29th. And things like last weekend and even how they played against Middle Tennessee State is making me think that I've again been too optimistic.
Right. So after two games now, Middle and Army, just getting by Army in overtime with that kick at the end of regulation must have been like 2 feet wide. I mean, it was that close. How do you feel now? Obviously, you just mentioned that you're questioning your one loss season, but I mean, what's going on? What was the problem?
I don't think that staff trusts the kids very well. Part of the problem is you're so starving for Michigan football news that all summer you're listening to insiders and people like Sam Webb that, you know, might have tidbits of information to share, and they talk about people that are going to step up and help us and how good Dylan and Shea both look, and this guy Dane was still at wide receiver is going to, you know, get some time, and then the season comes, and then you begin to wonder if that has any kind of relationship to the truth whatsoever. I mean, you know, they're limiting Shea on what he can do. He won't run or can't run, or he's too hurt to run, but you know, apparently 60% of Shea Patterson or whatever percentage he is better than the, you know, 100% of Dylan McCaffrey. They put McCaffrey in for a few snaps, and he, you know, is not allowed to run the full playbook. You know, if all you're going to do is hand off to Charbonnet, then you don't have a real true run pass option. And part of this, you know, is my thoughts, but part of it is exactly what Joel Klatt, who's somebody far smarter than me, said on the broadcast afterward. You know, something's wrong with that, right? I don't necessarily fault what they did on the defensive end with 14 points against that kind of offense, even though they couldn't stop that fullback trap for anything less than 4 yards. But they've got offensive problems. Of course, they're going to go into this week and they're going to talk about improvement week, and we're going to look at everything. And in the end, we won, and we'll see what happens at Wisconsin in 2 weeks. And I do think they'll match up better with Wisconsin than they did with these guys in Army, which just speaks to the fact they never should have scheduled the game in the first place.
Well, I was looking at some Urban Meyer quotes over the weekend, and actually, it wasn't that he said it over the weekend. He said it over the summer, and he said, hey, look, I mean, you can't just install a new offense and expect to be going hitting on all eight cylinders. But somehow, the Michigan Slappies, me, myself included, we were all led to believe that we have the people, we have the offensive line coach, we have everyone we need to just shift, right, from a pro style to a spread style with tempo, and obviously like a run pass option style, and obviously it's not so simple, or you know, we have the wrong people, right? So it's one of the two, and so I thought that was interesting that Urban said that. Also, I was looking at a lot of Twitter analysis over the weekend. you know, I've been quoted on the Michael Spath show Inside the Huddle on WTKA as being a Michigan slappy. I'm actually just joking about that. I'm pretty fair, level-headed about how good we are. Like, I feel like going from number 7 to number 10, you know, maybe we should actually be like 15th, okay? Maybe at the end of the year, we could be a number 7, but obviously we're not there yet. So what Spath and these guys were saying over the weekend on Twitter was that Shea was having a confidence problem. Like, he was handing off to Charbonnet every time when so many of the keeper options were there. Did you witness that?
Yeah, I was in the end zone seats. I was at the game, like I said. And so, you know, when you're in the end zone seats, you see the all 22 look that you don't get to all the time. And it looked like there was room for him to run off the ends. I mean, I'm not your best X's and O's person all the time, but I thought, gosh, of course, you look back at Shea Patterson, they would not have won that game in East Lansing last year without his running abilities and what he did on the ground and picking up a fourth down where, you know, they would not have moved the chains without him in that game and maybe would have lost it, even though it looked like a 21-7 score where Michigan just managed them. So that's a key part of what they do. And when he's unwilling or fearful of doing that for some reason, it just chops the legs off of what they can do on the offensive end. And also, I mean, he's inaccurate at times and it really hurts them. Like, you know, anytime you have Nick Eubanks running parallel to the line of scrimmage for, you know, 2 yards, that's a bad play because, number one, the guy's not going to catch it. Number two, even if he does, he's going to get crushed. And number three, Shea overthrows the guy by 3 feet. And we all know you can't overthrow tight ends because they're not athletic enough to reach up and grab balls that are 4 feet over their head. So they're just running some things that are low probability to begin with. And, then it doesn't help that Peoples Jones is out. So you're seeing more of Ronnie Bell. He can't field a punt or, you know, anything like that. I mean, he made a couple of catches, but I'm just hearing his name too much that where Collins and Black in certain times like this, that, you know, you got to have your eye be good. And so Peoples Jones comes back for Wisconsin, even if the guy doesn't play wide receiver, but just fields punts and can fair catch things responsibly. That's a plus, you know?
Yeah. Ronnie Bell fumbled a punt return. He also let a couple drop that cost us, you know, 10, 20 plus yards on each possession. So you're right. You know, Peoples Jones on the punt return is really important to get back. I thought Ronnie Bell did pretty well at receiver. I think he might have been our leading receiver for the day. He was targeted more than anyone. But you're right. I think that, you know, Black and Collins need to get more involved. Black seemed to drop 2 or 3 passes himself. One was a penalty, so it didn't matter on the end zone. But, you know, I felt like the game plan is flawed. I kind of agree. And then also, I wanted to get your take on the decision to go for it on 4th and 2 at the 20-yard line with about 9 minutes left in the game. It's 14-14. I mean, it's a slugfest. Don't you take the points?
Yeah, I mean, this is not video game football. So I understand that. Analytic-wise, if you need 2 or fewer yards, in theory, everyone says, well, your better bet is to go for it, and maybe in certain circumstances. But I think you absolutely take the points for this reason and this reason alone. The best you could have done by going for it is to ram it in for a touchdown that makes it 21-14. And I would submit to you that if you did that, and Army came back and Army scored, that they were going to line up and go for the win anyway. So it's not like by getting 7, you were guaranteeing yourself overtime as it was in this case. Maybe against the Wisconsin, someone feels that, you know, they're your equal. Getting up 21-14 is good because the worst you can do is go to overtime. But I'm thinking that even going getting a touchdown, they were just going to go down. And if they scored, they were going to run, you know, that fullback again for the game to go win 22-21. So what were you really gaining in terms of security? Not much. And you've got somebody, Jake Moody, that is virtually a guarantee from wherever they were, 36, 38 yards. And absolutely, if you took that and took the lead and they had to play from behind for the first time, maybe you impact their play calling a little bit and get them to act a little bit more desperately than just running Connor Slomka for 3.5, 4 yards a pop.
And I love the fact that Harbaugh and his post-game presser, he referenced the analytics. I think that's fantastic. But, you know, you can't just robo the game, you know, like follow the analytics on every play. You got to realize the situation. Yes, we have the probability of getting the 4th and 2 probably all game long. But the reality is when it's 14-14, you got to take the points. There's no doubt. What about looking ahead with Wisconsin with the bye week, and then at Wisc.
Well, Wisconsin's off too. I didn't realize that until I did some, you know, prep analysis type work for Saturday night that Wisconsin's, you know, had their two games. They've gone on the road, which Michigan hasn't done. And so now, you know, you go play them. And with the exception of that one safety they lost, they appear to be pretty healthy and things. I actually think that playing these guys historically, and we don't have a flawless record against Wisconsin by any means, but playing these guys historically has not been so bad because they run an offense that's very similar to what our guys see day to day in practice. We're going to hand it off and we're going to let Jonathan Taylor do the rest, and we're going to, you know, block like hell for the guy or whatever. And so Michigan defense wise might fare just as well, or, you know, still pretty good, better than most teams, let's say, against the Jonathan Taylor, because that's something they're accustomed to seeing, and just leave the wide receivers out with the guys that we have in coverage. And LeVert Hill obviously saved the game with his interception against Army, redeemed himself from the middle 10 drop that he had. Even 3 points there would have been a serious death blow for Michigan at that point. So I actually am more confident about how they'll do at Wisconsin than how they did against Army. But compared to what I wrote in the three weeks ago, where I thought we could go in and manage Wisconsin to a, you know, 10-point road win, I'm not, you know, certainly not feeling that good. But we'll see what they come out and do. I think you'll know in the first 6-8 minutes what kind of game that's going to be. And that's not a game you want to play from behind.
And how about your favorite 97 memory at Whiskey?
Oh, well, I actually was covering for the Daily a Big Ten championship cross-country meet in Bloomington, Indiana, and so I did not see any of the game live. But hearing it, and Frank Beckman, you know, just missed the commentary, you know, the play-by-play that Frank Beckman brought to that season, because, you know, his commentary was the caption to a lot of great plays in that season. And so Michigan took the first drive, went down there, and got down to about the 25-yard line, and they brought Woodson in the game, as they tended to do in that situation. And later, when I watched the TV broadcast, Keith Jackson said that, you know, Charles Woodson has entered the game at wide receiver. That will get Wisconsin's attention. and it did. And so, you know, Greasy took the snap and made sure. And that 97 team was so good about doing all the technical details right, and made sure that his throw to Woodson was backward. And when they ran the transcontinental play, the double pass play, and it was well blocked, and he made sure that his throw to Woodson was backward, so it was legal. And Greasy leaked out to the top of the TV screen, and the throw from Woodson was a lob, but it was a sure-handed throw and caught by Greasy. And then you had three or four large gentlemen escorting Greasy from the 25 to the end zone, and he got all the way down to the 1 yard line, and they hit him hard and knocked him out of bounds. But Greasy just got up. It was a gain of 24. And I actually think part of the, you know, not that you play games to get stats and position people for the Heisman, but part of the allure of doing that play was the idea that, you know, Woodson could return a punt for a touchdown in a season, have a touchdown reception, play defense, and have a, you know, interception returner or whatever for a touchdown, and then also throw for one. You know, that would have been kind of the grand slam of touchdowns, and Greasy got knocked out at the 1 yard line. And unfortunately, you know, it was not easy to score there. Michigan ran, I think, three times and could not get the ball in the end zone against Wisconsin. And Lloyd called timeout, and not always the most impressive dude, but on fourth and goal from the one, he decided, hey, a 3-0 lead is now what we came down here for. And he, stubborn and true to his core, ran it on fourth down and rammed it in for a 7-0 lead. And that was a difficult game, but they ended up going on 26-16.
It's funny how my memory has changed, because in my memory, it's like late in the third quarter, the offense is stalled and we need a trickery, you know, to jumpstart the situation. But yeah, that transcontinental is my favorite play, partly because you love it so much, to be honest. And then they broke out again in 2003 with senior Jack Navarre at Minnesota on a pesky Friday night against the Gophers, when they shifted the game from Saturday to Friday because the Twins were in the playoffs.
The strange stat is Michigan was never defeated in the Metrodome. I mean, all the times they had to play there and all the times they were at risk, and certainly falling behind multiple touchdowns the way they did that Friday night. There's a YouTube video out there where somebody, it might have been Wolverine Historian, compiled all of the transcontinental plays that he refers to as double pass, and compiles them all, because Michigan ran it against Illinois 1 year at home. And the only time they scored in that whole video, on that double pass play and actually put it in the end zone was the John Navarre play. And I would argue and, you know, say that he was probably the slowest of all the quarterbacks to actually run that play. But he scored, and he just kept running and looked like he was out for a Sunday jog at Kensington Metro Park. But he just kept running, and before you knew it, he was in the Metrodome end zone, you know, and touchdown John Navarre and touchdown Michigan. And then, you know, they ended up winning at, what was it, 38-35? You talk about reliable kickers. I don't know that Garrett Rivas ever missed a kick at U of M, and he had the game winner that night, you know, at Minnesota.
And you never doubted it. Never doubted it. So coming through the rest of this middle of the year for us, we've got Rutgers. I don't think we need to talk about that one. We've got Iowa at home. Much less scary at home, right?
Yeah. You know, used to be, if you looked at your Big Ten West crossovers and said you had Wisconsin and Iowa, you felt like, you know, those were two tough crossovers to draw. And Wisconsin still for sure, but maybe now you substitute out Iowa and say, hey, I don't really want to play Purdue and Rondale Moore. I don't really want to play Northwestern at Ryan Field. Maybe those scare you more than a home game against Iowa. We'll see what they do. They have the Cy-Hawk game this week. I think they go to Ames to play Iowa State, and that's always like an early litmus test for them. But you're right. When you compare playing them at home versus going to Kinnick Stadium where they're 8 feet from the field and those guys are, you know, slapping the padding and it feels very tight, you know, for the team and the supporters around you. Playing them in Ann Arbor, you know, against a team that their offense is probably a poor man's version of a Wisconsin, doesn't scare me the way that, you know, going into Madison does.
And then we have Illinois, which, you know, they have Brandon Peters, but he doesn't really scare me.
They've played well through two games, and I tell you, there's nothing I am happier to see than Brandon Peters going somewhere and having success. And I think as Michigan fans, you want to have the reputation for supporting people when they leave, even if it's not, you know, he didn't complete his career in the way that he envisioned when he got here. But hopefully that's what separates Michigan from other places, is that, you know, people online and in the stadium are supportive of this kid because he came here and probably was here for 3 years and gave a lot to Michigan football and played when they needed him to play and took some hits, right? So happy for him to have success in champ.
Yeah, I actually was at his last Michigan game, which was the South Carolina Bowl game at Tampa, and we had a 17-point lead. We couldn't score touchdowns. We choked it out, and I felt like leaving the stadium, like, he's not going to be the guy. That's how I felt.
Definitely was important to get Shea eligible at that point. You know, by no means am I saying we would be better off if he stayed, but like you always see in press releases when somebody leaves a team, we wish him the best.
Yes. Okay, then we've got some trickery here with at Penn State and home Notre Dame and back-to-back.
Yeah, that Penn State, we'll see what the TV networks do in terms of time. Would rather obviously avoid the whiteout, would rather avoid the 3:30. Playing them at noon reminds me of, I think it was Harbaugh's first year, maybe, and he had to play them at noon, went and won some 10 or 12-point game there where there was not a lot of stress about it. So something about playing them early at that place is better than playing them late. That'd be to our advantage. But, you know, Sean Clifford, who won the job there, he looked pretty good on Saturday night. It was just Buffalo, but they scored something like 28 points in the third quarter. And
Yeah, they were on the ropes early.
You know?
They were on the ropes early, just like we were against Army, but they pulled it out where we just continued to stall. What about Notre Dame?
We're both going to be different teams by then. I'm interested to see what they do. This ACC alliance that they have forces them to play some teams and go some places that they typically wouldn't do. So it's kind of interesting with them. You're usually used to playing them in week two, and then I don't need to watch NBC the rest of the year because I don't care what they do, and good luck to them in whatever bowl they end up in. In this case, I got to actually like pay some attention to them and see what they're doing as we go, just to see what we're in for. You know, if we're playing the way we're playing now and we don't evolve and improve, I think it's an academic conversation and we're going to get beat. So we'll see though. 5 weeks is a long time. It seems like others evolve. Let's see if Michigan evolves, but historically they kind of are what they are. I don't know that Michigan's a team that improves a lot in season compared to other groups, but maybe I'm not being fair.
Well, let's hope that we're like a beeline team this year where we finish strong in most cases.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
All right, so if these Penn State and Notre Dame games are close, maybe like a field goal, which could very well be the case, would you rather have Hayden Epstein, Garrett Rivas, Jeff Del Verne, or, and let me make it clear, Jeremy Miller snapping with a Jeff Del Verne kick, or Moody? Who are you going to go with?
I mean, you're clearly striking Epstein on the list. That guy cost Michigan with getting, you know, missing a kick at UCLA in 2000. He got a kick blocked at Washington in 2001 that would have turned a 12-6 game into a 15-6 game, and Michigan ends up losing. So he's not making any of my family feuds for any kind of kick, right? Because I don't value the guy that MGo Blog says is hitting it from 60 in practice. That's, like, meaningless to me. I'm looking for a guy that's go 15-18 and bend one in from 38 yards at Wisconsin. That's more interesting to me. And so Jeff Del Verne, 40 yards and under, I'd put my life on the line with him and Jeremy Miller snapping. Garrett Rivas would, you know.
I always thought Jeremy Miller should have won the Heisman in 97. I thought he was rock.
Yeah, he was. He was. I mean, Rivas and Moody's starting to be the same way, right? Like, I just don't see any way you start to use Nordine except in situations like they did against Army. 55 yards, 3 seconds left in the half. Go for it, kid. Just don't get it blocked and returned, but go ahead, kick it low and see what happens. But otherwise, you know, anything 42 and under, when you have a guy like Moody that strikes it very consistently, why not, right?
Yeah, I agree. So then we've got at Maryland, and I actually just booked my flight for the Maryland game where I'll be taking my son Jack. 2 years ago, I took Hunter, and he was 9 at the time, 9 or 10. Now Jack is 9, going on 10. And we had an opportunity to stay with Joe from school days and take a tour of Washington, D.C. before the game. And so we're going to do that again this year with Jack. So Maryland's looking good on the scoreboard for the first couple games, but they're not too scary to me.
We went to D.C. as part of our family vacation this year, and John Feinstein, the great Washington Post writer and author of Season on the Brink, with his season spent following Bob Knight, had recommended a pizza place on Twitter called Potomac Pizza, and one of the locations was in College Park. So we took the red line up there one night, ate at this place, and had it been a more iconic football stadium, it was going to be another 0.7 mile walk from the pizza place, you know, further away from the subway line to get to Maryland Stadium or Bird Stadium, Maryland Stadium. And so 0.7 there and 0.7 back was going to be more than the family would tolerate. But otherwise, we would have walked to see the football stadium and the basketball complex. So technically, at least we can check College Park off our list. But it looked like a nice town. And so write that down, Potomac Pizza, if you're interested.
I'll keep that in mind. And I got to tell you, when you're inside the game and it's like a big third down or something like that, on the big Jumbotron, they put up a big picture of a turtle, and the turtle has like these red eyes or something, and it says "Fear the Turtle," and I'm like, oh dear.
Yes.
They don't even have a student
section. Through two games, I fear them. Mike Loxley appears like he's gonna put up some points, and so it's not your, you know, anemic Maryland offense of old, right? I mean, they could do some things.
All right, I know we're running out of time. Do you have 5 more minutes for us?
Of course.
Okay. Now we're back at home for Michigan State. And, you know, growing up as a Spartan, as I say ad nauseum, I completely relate to the old little brother quote from Mike Hart. But it looks to me like Mark D'Antonio is a little overmatched, although – maybe their offense is coming back together. I think their defense is good, but their offense has been weak for some time now. But what's the importance of this game to you? Because I know you feel strongly about it.
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about the Ohio State game, and that's important, and that's great in the older generations, right? But I don't work with any Ohio State people. I work with plenty of Michigan State people. And if you're losing the Michigan State game, that's the foundation of the season and the foundation of the fans, you know, support in the coaching staff and the program, right? If you're beating Michigan State and losing to other teams, you know, you'll buy some time and you'll buy some support, right? But you just, Harbaugh's record is 2-2 against Michigan State. It should be 3-1, maybe even 4-0, depending
on how you look. I define it as 3-1. I don't really recognize the trouble with the snap outcome.
Oh my gosh, I'll never ever live that down. So, I mean, the thing to remember about this game is, growing up, when we grew up, Michigan did not lose at home to these guys. You know, with the exception of 1990 or what have you, Desmond Howard in the end zone, but had never lost at home, and that was a guarantee. And then you go up to East Lansing, you'd win, you know, every other year, 2 out of 3 times. Sometimes you get bit, okay, and that was how that went. And now you're in a world where the home team has not won that game in 5 years now. I mean, so you don't take any comfort from the fact, well, they're playing it at Michigan. Don't take any comfort from the fact that, oh, well, the game might be at night, because the game was at night 2 years ago, and Michigan, and you know, ended up getting burned. So it's really one of those things where you can't make any assumptions, because 2 years ago they beat Michigan at night in Ann Arbor, and everyone said, hey, Lewerke's a sophomore, you know, D'Antonio owns Harbaugh, next year the game's in East Lansing, good luck with that. And then, you know, you're into 2019 before you have another chance, and a lot changes in college football, and Michigan goes up and wins. So as you see, 2 weeks ago everyone probably gave Michigan State no chance to win that game in Ann Arbor. Now you see how both teams look. It's going to be a problem. It always is. And there's a very real chance Michigan could lose that game. And if they do, you know, the world will be turned on its axis again for Michigan fans. So you can't underestimate the importance of the Michigan State game. If you can't beat Michigan State, you're not beating Ohio State. And you may not be beating them anyway, but certainly if you lose.
And then we've got Indiana, where you predict another overtime win. I believe 2 out of the last 3 years have been overtime, if I'm not mistaken. Or 3 out of 4, or 2 out of 4, maybe.
The team is a total thorn in the side of Michigan every year. And it's, they could have put Indiana or Purdue in the Big Ten East. They ended up putting Indiana in the Big Ten East. And those guys are just 7-5, 6-6, and nothing comes easy. And so, shoot, there's some people that I know that say, hey, that's going to be a loss. But typically, Harbaugh has had a good record against teams that are beneath Michigan, right? He had a problem with big names, but whereas Lowe would throw in a stinker to Purdue or Iowa, you know, Harbaugh's been pretty good about when you wake up on a Saturday and think you're going to win, you typically do. Now, it may stress you out like last Saturday, for sure, but he seems to find a way to get it done against these lesser teams, but it's not always easy. I don't think it'll be easy there this year.
Yeah, Harbaugh's 4+ years now. I don't think we have any losses to underdog except for South Carolina in the bowl, if I'm not mistaken. But the teams that are even with us or favored over us, we suck, right? I mean, the record is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not going 12-0 and you're losing to somebody, it's the age-old question of, would you rather beat great teams and lose to mediocre teams, which drives everyone nuts, or beat everyone you're supposed to beat and lose to big name teams, which also drives everyone nuts. So, you know, anything other than going 11-12-0 is going to drive people nuts. The question is, you know, where loss is coming in. So at least there's predictability when you're beating the people you're supposed to beat, because Lloyd would drive us nuts by losing at, you know, Northwestern and then beating Ohio State. It was very inconsistent. So, you know, there's consistency here.
But that's what you expect. That's the law of averages, the law of large numbers. You're not going to lose 14 out of 15 to one team when you're, historically very equal. But you're not going to beat an Indiana for 35 straight years either. You know, I mean, usually you're going to have a slip and fall like you referenced, but then you're also going to beat the big boys and make an upset or whatever. But for Harbaugh, it's been straight beat everyone and then lose to just the team that you're underrated against. So that brings up Ohio State, and it's home. Hasn't helped us recently, but they have a new coach. They have a new quarterback. You have us losing 38-34. I mean, their offense looks really good. Our defense looks fine. Our offense looks relatively poor. I don't know if we could put up 34, but you never know in this game.
What surprised me most about it is, you know, 20 years ago, that was a game that was going to end 13-9, 20-14, right? I mean, points were going to be hard to come by, and now it's just people running wild on turf fields and nobody tackling anybody and a lot of chunk plays for 20, 30, 50 yards at a time, and the points are just going off like a pinball machine. So, you know, I'm not surprised anymore to see a high-scoring game the way I used to be, but the bottom line is no matter what Michigan does defensively this season and how much Don Brown may say he's learned and prepared for these guys and devoted parts of his prep during the season to what he's going to do for Ohio State, you're still going to go to bed on whatever it is, Friday, November 29th, and you're not going to have a clue whether you can trust the guy or not on Saturday at noon. I mean, that's just the way it is. And that doesn't even speak to the struggles of the offense, but that speaks to, you know, everyone says, well, Don Brown, you gave up 62 to Ohio State. 55. I think there was a special teams touchdown in there, but either way, I mean, you're not going to have any idea whether he can, you know, counter the basic slant over the middle or not. And we know one thing about him: he's stubborn enough to change what he's going to do. And you know, I guess that's both to be commended as well as criticized, right?
Yeah, I don't feel good about it at this point, that's for sure. But you know, last year on Friday night, I was on the MGO blog podcast as one of their sponsors, and I had supreme confidence. John U. Bacon was there on the podcast, and he had supreme confidence. Everyone was just way overconfident. Bacon was like, you know, they're going to pull out some plays that you haven't seen all year. And I was like, oh, really? You know, how do you know that? He's like, just trust me on this. And so what did we see from the offensive game plan? You know, more of the same. Like you referenced, the defense couldn't be trusted. But how do you go from supreme confidence to getting shell-shocked?
You could just see in the first drive that this was not going to be Michigan's day and they were going to struggle. Speaking of the concept of, hey, they're going to pull out some plays you haven't seen, nothing drives me nuts more in college football or pro football than when a college team that's 8-4 and has disappointed people pulls out five trick plays in the, you know, Music City Bowl to beat somebody else from the SEC or something like that. And you're like, where was this all year? Or when the Lions are 4-11 and they're in the last game against Green Bay and that's when they run their fake punt and show how versatile they are. It's like, you know, where's this been? I don't know what it is about when there's no consequences to something that just takes the governor off and let these people play fun, unpredictable football, but it does seem to happen at both levels. So yeah, you know, we're saving these plays and, you know, part of it is like, okay, well, where were these plays when you were losing at Iowa, you know, 6 weeks ago? I don't get it.
Yeah, I no longer subscribe to the theory that, you know, we've reined in the playbook. We're not letting it all out. It's only week two. We're only doing the simple stuff. I don't believe it at all. We're not holding out. We're trying to win. You know, anyone who says that, I'll just roll my eyes at this point. And then I also want to go back to 2011, the last time we won, the Denard year in the Big House. I'm sitting there and, again, supreme confidence, because it was the Luke Fickell year where Ohio State had a new coach, a new quarterback. They lost Tressel, all that. And they were bad. You know, they were like a 6-6 type team. And I'm sitting there and we find ourselves like with 45 seconds left in the game, up by like four or something. And Braxton Miller's at quarterback marching down the field. All of a sudden he throws a 40-yard bomb to a wide open receiver right in front of my eyes. And thank God it was an overthrow. It was incomplete, but the dude was wide open. It was a game. That was the game right there. And we put ourselves in a position to lose. I think there was some BS there at the end where Fitzgerald Toussaint was in the end zone and they did some trigonometry upstairs to call it back. And I thought, I kind of like just sat down, like everyone was standing up. I kind of sat down, put my hands in my face in my palms on my knees and was just like, if we can't win today, when are we going to win? When could this be? And it almost got taken away in 2011 after the supreme confidence. So, you know, I'm just going to learn not to have supreme confidence, manage my expectations. It's not a loser's mindset. It's just like, you know, show me, prove it to me. Let's get rid of all the July Heisman Trophy winners in the August national championships, and let's just get it done.
For sure. I mean, I think they lost a touchdown to a penalty late in that game, and then something happened where didn't Michigan get like two penalties they enforced against them on the same play, like holding as well as a, you know, dead ball foul that all of a sudden put them for a very long field goal just to make it like a 6-point game, and he kicked it. I mean, you know, 3 points going to a 6-point lead doesn't help you much. I think it was, it made it six, but he kicked it and made it, and then they had to survive one last another drive or whatever, and you're right, without that, the streak would be to what, 04-19? At least 2011 prevents people from saying they've won the game 15 years in a row. I mean, that'd be, a, you know, unbelievable. So you're right. You can't take anything into account. And somebody I knew that used to be in college sports coaching says, people think you just roll out the balls and kick people's rear ends. And it just doesn't work that way with these, you know, 18-23-year-old kids. It's just, there's too many variables.
Well, there you have it from Christopher Dupre, former Michigan Daily beat writer. He predicts a one loss season, and I think maybe he'll still stick to that. Is that right? One loss?
I'll stick to it. I've made history out of overestimating what these guys can do, but I'll stick to it.
Yeah, it might be a two loss team ending up back in Tampa against South Carolina. All right, Chris, thanks for the time. We appreciate your expertise, and maybe we can do this again.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.